Where does the name Spud come from?
It was given to me in 1980 by a golfing friend of mine, and it was in honor of Spud Webb. I'm height challenged,
nice.
As you know. See, you got the nice elevated chair for me here, so I look about the same height as you.
Listen, when we started, you were like way, way low. I'm like, Spud, we got to bring that chair up.
It's pretty good now. I feel like an adult.
By the way, you brought us all sunglasses in honor of the eclipse. You've even got two pair on, which I think is very impressive. Tony Gump over here, he's got his. Tony, you look like Mr. Cool Guy. I mean, look at those.
Mr. Cool Guy?
Look at those glasses.
Okay.
Those are actually pretty sweet. I like those. I went with the green.
I didn't know if I would go blind in here because other than an injury or genetic problems, there's only two ways you can go blind. That's watching an eclipse and the other way your parents warned you about.
Yeah, you end up with hairy palms on the other end. You don't want to do that. Did you get to see any of the eclipse today?
I walked my dog outside. He was agitated. I think, you know, they say pets have some kind of innate feeling for it. He was agitated most of the day. I took him outside, and I looked down at the ground the whole time like I was Pigpen, and I'm just strolled around, and he went out, and I brought him back in. And I live in an apartment where there's a breezeway, so I can see outside without looking outside, and it was never really impressive in any way. It wasn't anything. And then when I was driving over here, it was dark, and I was wondering, is that eclipse related or clouds?
Yeah.
Turns out it's clouds. And I was driving east, so the sun was behind me. So I think I'll be able to see tomorrow.
Yeah, we didn't have any fun with the eclipse, and we had a whole ordeal where Trish was adamant about watching the eclipse with her honey. And so I'm like, okay, well, before we do the podcast, I'll come by, we'll watch it. And then there was the hubbub about the glasses, which we talked about on the radio. And when I get there, it's all clouds. I didn't even get to see it. I saw pictures. Tony Gump, did you see the eclipse at all?
Not really. I was too busy doing yard work.
So. Tony, by the way, Tony never stops. It's just constant, like, moving around. I'll hit him up on the weekend. I'll be like, hey, man, let's, you know, we sometimes make plans and they fall through a lot. But I'll be like, well, you want to just, you know, hang out? You want to play some video games? I can't do that. I got too much to do. It's a list of mile long.
I have friends like that, too. I have too little to do, and I like it that way.
Well, and if he was not the way he is, the studio would still only be halfway put together.
It's impressive. I mean, it's impressive enough on the internet, but when you look around in here, you should give people a tour sometime. Take your mic and walk around and run the cameras.
Well, we're very selective about who we let up here. We've already rigged it up like Fort Knox, and so we're like, you know, there's been times where we're like, we want to go outside and like do shoot some video, and then we're like, we don't want people to know where we're at. Like,
did any of your listeners or any of your friends travel to see the eclipse in the totality?
Not that I know of.
Tony, any of yours?
No, nobody that I know. My sister's in Cleveland, but I haven't talked to her about it.
My sisters are in Houston, and they didn't see much. It was a little cloudy, and that wasn't right in the path like Dallas was. But I have a friend who went to Texas to the totality and others who went to Indiana to find it there. That's chasing.
That's dedication, dude.
I mean, it must be important to you.
I don't know. I mean, I get there's not much difference in this eclipse than there was the one in 2017, if you ask me. It all kind of looks the same. I mean, it's just like it looks like the moon, but it's the sun. It's a crescent sun. Like, I don't get it. I understand the importance of it, but I just don't understand why everybody makes such a big deal about it.
I'll tell you, here's a pretty capsule summary of me is, I went. That's fine. You're good. I went with my then wife and her two children to Europe over Christmas vacation in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And we got to the Eiffel Tower, and my first thought was, yep, it looks just like it does in a picture.
Yeah.
You know, I just am not impressed with sightseeing of any kind. But I would go, like, if somebody said, let's go to London. If Wimbledon's on, I would watch that as a sporting event. But in walking around at museums and the beef feeder hats and all that's Big Ben doesn't interest me at all.
Yeah, I don't. I'm kind of that way, but it's like, I remember going to New York in like 2010, and when you go to like Times Square, for instance, You spent your whole life seeing it in movies,
right,
TV shows and everything.
So New Year's Eve.
Kind of, yeah. When you first see it, it kind of seems like a big deal. You're like, oh, God, you know, I've been watching this my whole life, and here it is right in front of me. But I can't really think of anything else I've ever seen where I'm like, oh, my God, there it is.
Yeah, I was that way. I saw the Twin Towers in 98. It was October of 98. I got to go see those before they went kaput.
Before they went kaput.
Well, you know. Yeah.
Did you get to see Building 7 before it went kaput?
I saw Building 7, but I didn't really know it was 7. It was just another building next to it. I wasn't aware of all that until after the event.
You led me into a side story here. The guy who lives with me when he's not away teaching, he's teaching in Kalamazoo, Michigan this year, but he was on Wall Street. He was a big Wall Street guy, and he's been sober for 34 years, but he's been in AA, active in AA every day for 34 years. And the day after 9/11, he was in Connecticut, and went into Manhattan, and there was an old man sitting there that had been there like since 4:30. Peter got there at like 5:30. And he said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I lost my son yesterday, and this is the only place I know where I won't drink."
Wow.
So that's as gut-wrenching as you can imagine.
That's wild. Wow. God, I can't imagine. I mean, just how we all felt collectively on that day. There was vulnerability, but also a sense of togetherness that we as a country have not felt since.
And anger.
We were all on the same page on several levels, whether it was anger or being emotional about the whole thing or what. We were all on the same team, and it's never been that way since.
No, it might take a similar event. Where were you on that day?
I was in, I think I was in like 2001. I was in like 10th or 11th grade, so I was at school, and I think I was in between classes or something, and somebody yelled at me. They're like, "Oh, get to so-and-so's class. There's, planes hitting buildings, blah, blah, blah." And at that point in my life, you know, when somebody said World Trade Center, it didn't really click with me what the World Trade Center was.
I didn't really either. I was at home, and Richard Dixon called me and said, "You need to come up here." And I was alert enough and awake enough to know what was happening. And I went up there, and they broadcast on all five stations simulcast from that studio at the other end where Dixon was doing his morning show with Jay Willoughby, and everybody piled in, and Herb Winches was doing news that day from that place, but everybody that was up there was focused on that one thing, and that it was a horrible day, but it had its silver lining a little bit.
What was the station he was on at that time?
1070 AM.
Okay, so WAPI, the same that we're at
WAPI
now.
Yeah, all the stations were the same frequency and had the same names. ZRR was broadcast, but that wasn't Mason and Dixon. That was ZRR was doing John Boy and Billy, I think.
But Dixon's been on this station since 2001.
Well, he got the opportunity in Orlando and went down there and had two good years and then got replaced by Bubba the Love.
Oh, that's good. That's God, I wish I would have known about that when he was on the show. I'd have worn my Bubba the Love Sponge shirt.
He would like
here.
That. And then he built a studio in his house in what was pretty much a closet because mm-hmm. it was a one-person thing, and he was on an internet group that took these feeds and put them out over there. You could sell your own sponsorships, and they sold a few. It was kind of a time-sharing thing, mm-hmm. and he did that for a few years, and then when 99.5 reassembled to do the morning talk show and get into the talk business live and local 12 hours at that time, they invited him to come back up and do it, and that's what brought him back, and he's been on ever since the station. The opening of the station was at the grand opening was on the rooftop at Southern Kitchen down in Midtown.
Oh, wow.
And we broadcast out loud there, and it was a night, and then it just mushroomed. Leland was there playing the bass guitar. Richard was playing the drums and some talking going on. It was quite an event.
So with the history of Spud, what were you doing in your early days? Like, what was your first career path?
My career path was picked out for me by my mother in the cradle, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to undergraduate school at Rice in Houston,
mm-hmm.
and then back to Alabama Law School, and had an agreement with my mother that if I finished at Rice, I could take a year off and go to Las Vegas and pursue whatever I thought I could pursue there, but she reneged on the agreement.
Yeah.
So I went straight to law school, finished law school, went to the firm Cerruti downtown, and I worked there for 20-odd years. And then I retired, and I had enough to live on if I didn't make any further mistakes.
Yeah.
Which is getting married or owning a house or, you know, buying a horse or anything.
You never got married?
Three times.
Three times.
But I was out of all three. I'm master sergeant of marriage, three up and three down.
Three strikes, you're out.
That's right.
You're not going for a fourth.
I got to get Jennifer Aniston to quit calling me. I'm just not interested.
You just ain't going to do it. Oh, man. So you were an attorney?
Yeah.
For all how long?
21 years.
Really? When did you stop? When did you retire?
95 or 6. 96, I would guess.
Gosh,
and it wasn't long after that.
A long time ago.
I've been retired a long time. Retirement is nice. Those people who say you'll get bored, they don't know.
Well, I was wondering when we booked this, I'm like, I wonder what kind of finagling we're going to have to do, because I didn't know what your schedule was like.
I don't have a schedule.
I honestly, I didn't know if you were still a lawyer or what. I just didn't know.
I have no schedule. The start in radio came when Herb Winches had a golf show, 1 hour a day on this. That they had a format that nobody has anymore, where the 11 o'clock hour was different sport every day and different people every day. And he and I did the golf show. He invited me in to do it with him for about 5 or 6 years. And then I did my own on the AM station where I bought the time.
Yeah.
And then they got me on FM where I bought the time, which was the best example of a sole proprietorship any business ever had. I paid the station $250. That got me the studio for an hour, all the prep I wanted to do up there, and a producer.
Mm.
So that was, I had one expense.
Yeah.
I actually lectured to an economics class at the Mountain Brook High School on business organizations, and I said, here's the best example of the simplest one. I had one expense. Everything I sold was 100% mine to keep.
So you did, what was your first deal in radio? Was it that?
It was
the golf
with
show.
With Herb.
Okay.
That was the first non-paying.
And then after that, you're like, hey, I can do this.
Well,
this
I met Richard when I was up there, and we got along real good, and then he included me in an hour of his show ever since he came back.
Is that when you and Dixon became friends?
Yeah.
At
the station when I was doing the sports show, and Richard and I became friends, the first time I walked in there, he said, oh, yeah, you're the guy who does 6 hours of prep for a one-hour show. I said, that's what was bred into me from childhood, over-prepare every time. And so I would do that, and I could take trade. So when you buy one of those shows, you know, you take trade whatever you want for.
You get whatever you want.
That's
from
right.
Anybody.
And I had a real successful enterprise for a while, and then I hung out with Richard. So I hadn't made a dollar since then.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to Richard Dixon, everybody knows who he is now. Was he different back then? Was he wild? That's what I'm trying to say.
No, he was wild, but that was before I knew him.
Okay.
You were telling me a little bit about your backstory, and it sounded a lot like his.
Probably so, yeah.
But he's always been in love with radio like you. He has a nice voice for it like you. And he came out of his dark days and he loves it. I don't think if he hit the lottery he would quit. I honestly don't think.
Oh, I've thought about that a million times. I was like, man,
billion times this past weekend, but some guy in Oregon took my money.
I'm like, yeah, if that just happened, because I don't really play the lottery, you know, if it's there, may grab a couple scratch offs or something for the hell of it. But
I'm just curious, were you civil or were you criminal attorney?
Civil. Okay. I represented creditors in the civil court system and in the bankruptcy court system. And that, toward the end of my career, it was almost exclusively bankruptcy, creditors. I described myself as the reverse Robin Hood, stealing from the poor to give back to the rich.
what was the craziest thing you saw in your career? Like, do you have a particular case that was just wild and you couldn't believe it?
Yeah, I got...
I like the way you switch in those glasses,
well, you know,
too.
I
that's
don't
impressive.
Want to be blind here. I had a case... And it probably, I don't want to get in the weeds on the technique of it, but I had a lead pipe winner. It couldn't lose. In fact, it was so simple that it was foolish that I even had to try the case. But I tried the case, and I lost. a lady got on the witness stand, the debtor lady got on the witness stand, and the judge was one of these old Southern gentleman types, you know, like Harlan Sanders kind of, you would think. And he just felt sorry for the lady, and I lost the case. And at the end of the case, I mean, I turned into Lou Piniella. I was kicking dirt, yelling at him, all the rest. And I was just angry. I said, Judge, you teach bankruptcy law. If you gave this question on a law exam to your class, they would laugh at how simple it was. Do you want me to just tear this page out of the book? And I mean, I'm Earl Weaver, Lou Piniella, and Bobby Cox all into one. And he just sat there and took it, thank God, because I probably should have ended up in jail.
Right.
But he knew he was wrong, and he let me vent like that. And I learned a great lesson. We lost the case. I was representing a bank. We lost the case, and I walked outside with the manager who was representing the bank with me, and she walked out and she said, that was great. I said, what? We lost. She said, I know. The bank's not going to miss the $7,000 that mattered. The bank won't miss that. But you stood up for us, and you showed, I mean, that's what I want my lawyer to be, is passionate about winning for me. Plus, you made the lady cry a little bit, and that helped me too. Yeah. A little schadenfreude there. So,
you lambasted the poor on behalf of the rich.
I learned a great lesson as a lawyer that day. Be your client's best advocate. Whether you win or lose, if you fought for them, that's all you want.
Do you see a lot of people, and it doesn't have to be civil or criminal or anything for that matter, but lawyers in that industry that don't do a very good job? I say this because when I got divorced, which was back 2016, 2017, there's no way my lawyer was actually on my side. Like, he was just, you know, not putting up much of a fight. It was like, hey, let's just do this. Do you see a lot of that in that industry?
There's a lot of people in it just for the money. And so whatever way they can maximize the money, some of them extend cases beyond where you have to in order to keep charging you. Some people will settle because if they tried the case, they could lose, and that would be zero. You know, all these lawyers who, if we lose, you pay nothing. So if they lose the case, they get nothing. So they get offered maybe less than the case is worth, but they take it to ensure that they don't get a zero. There's a lot of that, but there's a whole lot of very dedicated, honest, hardworking lawyers who aren't that way, and I don't know how an ordinary client can distinguish.
Well, that was my next question. How do you tell the difference? Which is irrelevant to this audience, who should be calling Chuck Davis for
any
of those needs.
And Chuck is excellent.
I love Chuck.
Chuck's good, actually.
And so there's no way to like kind of vet them as you look.
Well, if you can find people who've used them.
Yeah.
If you went good looking for an attorney and you found a person who's been in, like if a person was looking for an attorney for divorce now and they said, Andrew, what about this guy? And it was your guy. No.
Yeah.
No, I may not know any others, but a lot of people contact me and say, I need a lawyer for X, and I'll go find them one I know is good.
So you need a lawyer buddy to help you find a good lawyer.
That's right.
Okay.
If your lawyer... And Chuck would be the same way. If you gave him a complex class action suit that's outside of his realm and outside of his resources, he could point you straight to where you ought to go to get your matter handled.
Right.
And there's, in every area of the law, there's stuff too complex for a general practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a primary care physician. If I got a primary care, but if I get cancer, I want an oncologist.
Right.
And so my primary care physician says, this is the best oncologist around, so that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what we tell people, too. Like, if Chuck can't get you, he's going to send you to somebody that can. But that's got to be, I get anxiety going in courtrooms.
Of course.
Even when you remember I did a jury duty not long ago. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. And I knew, I was like, there's a really good chance they're not going to pick me. But just going through the process, I was like, God, man, I don't want to be here. I'm getting bad. And then we get in the courtroom, like where they're telling us what the case is before they pick the 12 jurors. And it's a pedo deal. It's a guy that's like being accused by a girl who was 12 at the time of you know, sexual assault. And I'm like, I got to go, y'all. I got a radio show to do. I don't want to be here. I don't like this. And so I don't know that I could do that.
I have a good friend, been friends since we were kids, who's an emergency room doctor. And I said to him, you see these people come in bleeding or dying or sick to the gills, and you don't know if they're going to survive or not. Do you get nervous? He said, At first, I did, but I've seen so much now, I'm not nervous. I said, that amazes me. He said, do you know how nervous I would be if I walked into a courtroom to try a jury case?
Mm.
And it dawned on me that, yeah, I've been in there 1,000 times. I'm not nervous when I walk into court. I'm not nervous when I go play trivia.
Yeah.
I'm not too nervous when I go play bridge, which are the 3 things I do most. But if you go to unfamiliar territory, I mean, do you know how many, we've had guests on your radio show that are scared to death,
mm-hmm.
and when they walk out, that wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
But your skill level comes through to them that you can take an ordinary guest who's an expert at something, but nothing near radio, and you can guide them through and keep them between the lines, and that's a skill too.
Yeah, we kind of, and Tony will affirm this. I mean, we don't do, especially with this podcast, we don't do any prep. I mean, we didn't talk about anything that we were going to talk about on the show. I'm like, let's just bring them on and let's just talk. That's the kind of podcast I liked watching anyway. You know, you got the Joe Rogan stuff, and you can tell there's no prep involved there. It's just like, come on, let's talk. Let's just see what happens.
That's right. The show is not nearly as structured. These that I've listened to from you are not nearly as structured as your radio show, which is got the segments and hit the time clocks and all the mm-hmm. rest. And this is really get to know somebody
mm-hmm.
at the basic level, not their radio personality, but here's who you are. Here's what I've done. Here's my backstory. Here's what I like and don't like. And so your listeners get to know something and you can do a more relaxed thing.
So you've been doing radio, just all over the place for a long time with Dixon and everything.
Yes.
Have you ever seen anything just absolutely crazy in the radio realm where you're like, maybe it makes you uncomfortable? Maybe
you know,
fights break out between coworkers or some guy takes a dump on a desk. I don't know.
Oh, the story goes, and I'm sure you've heard it, about the guy that left a burrito in the microwave over the weekend, burned it and left it there. That was before you?
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Oh, okay, you can go, but the story is legendary about they couldn't even fumigate the place.
Really?
It was so stenchy up there that you almost couldn't walk in. They were thinking about getting gas masks because they couldn't get this. It had pervaded all the couches, all the chairs, all the baffles. Everything was up there that guy cooked his overcooked his burrito and then left it in there burning in the microwave. And
Hey, what did he set the timer at? Like 2 days?
I guess. Or he just turned it on high and let it run. Figured I'll remember, and then probably got a call or something happened like that. The other stories that I remember, and I'm sure there are when there's ice on the roads and people go in there and camp out in there and take a shift here and try to crawl up that hill to try to get your four-wheel vehicle up there to do your show, because the show must go on. And back then, they didn't have places like this that you could get to and do the show from there. And, of course, the producers had to go anyway, and the engineers had to go anyway. And so the stories of sleeping up there and eating this and that and finding old ramen noodles that were out of date.
That sounds like fun probably, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago. I think it'd be fun to, like, camp out with your coworkers. But nowadays it's like, if I don't sleep in my own bed, I'm not going to be able to function the next day. So I love the fact that we've got this. I think at WDNG out in Anniston, where I started, we had the big, what was it, 2014, when everything froze over, everybody got stuck.
That was one of them.
It was me and one other guy. We did 14 hours straight of radio, just me and him. That was it. That's all we had. And it was a big deal because out in Anniston, you've got like Noble Street, Quintard Avenue.
Yeah, the bankruptcy court is right there on Noble Street.
Yes.
That big white marble building.
You've got how it iced over. There's tons of traffic. Everybody's stuck. And we're the only station in town that's still broadcasting. So we had this captive audience that we had never had before. More listeners than we could have ever imagined at that 1,000-watt station. And we just kept it going for like 14 hours straight.
And they need you. That is when radio is at its best, is in a crisis, when people need you. And you're saying, is there any way somebody can get a ventilator to Joe over here and on 14th Avenue? Or this, the power went out, and I have a friend, she since passed away, older than I, but the power went out, and she says, I'm on oxygen. I've got to have power back. And she called, and they didn't do anything, and a couple hours later, she said, I just want to tell you that I'm about to die.
Oh, and man.
And they got her fixed up. But that's when radio is at its best. Callers call in. I've always liked callers. Some people don't. Richard does and doesn't. Leland does, and you don't do so much of callers, a little bit. But
I got in this weird habit of where when I first had 2 hours, I was like, there's no way I can take calls, or I won't right. have any show to do. And now I got a little more breathing room, but it's hard for me to get out of that habit, I think. But I'm like you. I've always loved the call-in shows. I mean, Paul Feinbaum built an empire on
Correct.
That. Leland's always done a good job with it because you never know what you're going to get. Sometimes, I would dare say a lot of times, you get somebody call in and it's, you know, as the host, you're doing this right here.
Oh, yeah.
Waiting for the phone call to be over, you know,
right.
like cut it. But there's some gems in there sometimes.
Sometimes, in the past, when I have substitute hosts, sometimes an expert would call in. Like during this last bridge collapse, you get a structural engineer
oh, yeah.
who happens to listen to your show, and now they call in, and you can pretty much just lean back and ask a question. They'll give you 5 minutes, 5 minutes on that, and what happened here and what should have happened here, and how did the people not get off the bridge in time when you had enough time to warn the the cars. You stopped the cars at both sides, but you didn't get Jose off the bridge in time, and he ended up drowning, and a few of them ended up dangling and whatever. But an expert, I always thought that if I had my own show, I would do a segment called 101 at least once a week on something that people have heard about, like the Federal Reserve System. We hear about it. We talk about the Fed.
Oh, Tony Gump. Here
Did
we
I
go.
Hit something? Get me started.
Did I hit something?
Yeah. Oh, you have no idea. Tony Gump is. We, for a while, we don't have it up now, but we had U.S. Debt Clock, which, you know.
I've seen that.
It's constantly. We had a screen up, and it would stay on the screen. We've got it right there behind you now, but it just keeps the numbers running. And we would have it every episode. It would be over here to the side. It had its own screen. And we would watch those numbers go up. But this man right here, he is Mr. Federal Reserve. Knows it from top to bottom. Actually, Tony is probably classified in a group of, like, people that suffer from, I don't know. I mean, some people may call it, like, a mental illness. But he didn't have it until he actually learned about how deep this stuff goes, and now it's just made him crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what an expert on the Federal Reserve is, but I'm probably close at this point, I'd say.
So if you got on and you said 101, said we're going to have this, and you preview it for a few people who say, I want to hear that, the fare tax, and I know some people on our station, I still call it our station,
yeah.
have done that, but or taxation, the tax code, you know, Eclipse. You could have said, here's a one-on-one, everything you want to know about the eclipse in a 20-minute segment. You don't have to do a lot of it. A 20-minute segment that's just informative. But, Tony, I would have loved to have had you on and said, okay, let's talk about the Federal Reserve. What is it? Who is the chairman? How does it get there? What do they do? What don't they do? Do they have they have power that Congress should only have? You know, just that. Way to go. When I did my golf show, I had a guy named Peter Kessler. He was one of the original hosts on the Golf Channel when they started, which was the germ of that was in Birmingham. They set it up Orlando, but Mr. Gibbs and Arnold Palmer and all those people got together in Birmingham and then decided to start the Golf Channel. And he was such a good guest because you could wind him up and you could ask one question and he'd give you 5 minutes of answers. You've got the other kind where you have 5 minutes of questions and one quick answer.
Yeah.
Please, you know, this is killing
me. That's interesting.
Me.
Yeah, that's that would actually be a good idea because there's when you talk about the Federal Reserve, nobody's really talking about that. Nobody's asking questions like, okay, we're, you know, $30-something trillion in debt. What happens when they're like, hey, pay up now? Like, and we can't pay up. What happens? What do they do? What do they do, Tony? Do they take our houses? Do they take everybody's property?
And it's so funny that when the debt was rising and rising under Obama, the Republicans were screaming, we're going to go broke. And then Trump came in, and for whatever reason, you can blame it on the COVID, but then he ran the debt up, and the Democrats said, you're spinning us into oblivion. Now, Biden, more and more, now it's... Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who was in financial service. I said, at what point do we just have more than we can stand? Because at the percentage of, Tony will understand this better than I do, but the percentage of our income, which we get from taxes and other and a few fees and this and that, now is a huge percentage of our national expenditure, the interest on the debt.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you won't have enough money for Social Security or Medicare or taking care of the parks or the interstate highways. So, you know, at some point it has to break you. You can't just spend forever unless you want to mortgage Guam.
Yet. And a,
you know,
I mean,
if you
I guess
said
we could if you,
said
if you
to
want
China,
to.
We'll sell you Guam.
Yeah.
We'll sell you Guam, and you give us $20 trillion, and they would buy it in an instant, and you'd be solvent again. But then you wouldn't have Guam. So
maybe that's the deal with Taiwan and everything else. And the Biden administration is kind of like, hey, I mean, Taiwan's like, whatever. Maybe that's like we're selling it to China, even though we don't technically own it.
Well, see, China only owns a certain portion of the debt, and other countries own other portions, too. The Federal Reserve, I believe, has like $7 or $8 trillion that's on their balance sheet. We owe them. So it's really
we owe us. To me, that's we owe us.
Well, you could say that, but not really, because the Federal Reserve is its own independent company.
Does it have? Does it have? Does it have?
It has stock
assets.
It has assets. It has stock.
Does it have liabilities?
Yes, it does. It's a balance sheet for liabilities too. But they kind of make their own rules up as they go to keep the fraud going.
The fraud. Mm. So we're on the same side on this.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, there's fact and then there's fiction, and I just happen to know the Federal Reserve is as federal as Federal Express.
Again, he used to be a normal human being that just kind of went through life and watched Cardinals baseball and everything, and then once he found out about this, it was like...
I
got to tell you, though, my dad didn't know the answer when I was a kid at who ran the Federal Reserve and who set the interest rates. So it fascinated me. And a lot of people don't know, before the Federal Reserve took the act in 1914, they actually passed it December 24th, 1913. They tried a 1% income tax in 1892, and it passed, but then it got struck down by the Supreme Court because income tax is unconstitutional. It still is. So technically...
I thought the 16th Amendment authorized the federal government to have an income tax passed during Lincoln's time to fund the Civil War.
Well, Lincoln fought the idea of having a Federal Reserve, and that's why he came out with the greenback. He went against the idea of a central bank, and that's what I personally think got him killed. You know, and JFK did the same thing with silver in 62, and look where that got him.
And then gold. Yeah. Now we have nothing but paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all...
But it all ties together.
But if you could sell Guam for... What is our thing? $31 trillion.
It's 34 and a half.
Trillion dollars. You'd be solvent. In fact, you'd be plus because you wouldn't have any interest payment on your debt at that point, but the strategic value.
I mean, are you going to miss Guam?
I'm not, but I don't know.
I'm not going to miss Guam. Tony, you going to miss Guam?
No, I wouldn't miss Guam.
Let me ask you two guys a question. I've been pondering this lately. Let's say you could go to Washington, D.C. and get a bunch of inside experts on everything and say, tell me everything I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me everything I don't know, even if you think it would scare the crap out of me. I want to know everything about the inside of 9/11 or Kennedy's assassination. Everything you haven't told us. They keep pushing back the information on, and the FBI,
yeah,
and the CIA, and the Justice Department. I want to know everything about this. I want to know if that big volcano under Yellowstone is going to blow.
Right.
All these things, outer space junk and space and the preparedness for war and what would happen if Iran throws a nuclear bomb or some kind of bomb into Israel. What would happen then and what are we going to do? So I want to know all of that. I'm not sure I could handle it. You know, it's Tom Cruise.
That's true.
I might be Tom Cruise.
Well, and it's a matter of, you know, the American people couldn't handle it. That's for sure.
So I know that's why they don't want to disseminate it. But you know, are we supposed to keep secrets from our own people because we're scared they couldn't handle it?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think you just need to drop it. And I think what would happen is if you came out and you took that whole list of things, you said, okay, the U.S. government did 9/11, all this other stuff, half the population, at least half the population would still be like, oh, okay, when's the next Lizzo concert, you know, or New York or earthquake, you
or
know?
without doing that, I got two jobs. My kids don't have adequate clothing. I can't really worry about Iran.
Bingo.
And that's fair. That yeah. means I can't expect them to worry about global problems when if there's a leak in your basement, there's very damn little going on internationally that's mm-hmm. that you're going to pay attention to.
That's why the economy being in the position it is works out for the government so well. And in this case, Democrats are in power. It works out for them to be able to do the things they want to do that normally civilized, level-headed people would be like, no, you don't need to do that. That's a bad idea. But if they're worried about getting by or they're having to work two jobs or they can't afford groceries, like they're not worried about what bill Congress is passing or what executive order Joe Biden signed
Correct.
That day.
That's right.
And so they get away with
and
so much
more. And the
border
stuff doesn't affect them.
Right.
You take a guy living in a poor neighborhood in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worried about crime, and he's worried about money. And he's not worried about the border, and he's not worried about Ukraine, and he's not worried about the next president, except as to how it would affect him. I've always wondered if what's best for the country is the sum of what's best for each of us individually. That if you just ask each person, what's important to you, what do you want, what don't you want, and you could somehow add those up, is that what's best for the country, or are there things bigger that they can't expect ordinary people to allow for?
Man, we're such a diverse country, and people's priorities are so different that I don't even know that there's any middle ground to say everybody could agree on this issue.
There's not. And we go back to back to 9/11 since then, and there's not. And I've got a feeling that this after this election, no matter how it goes, it's going to get precipitously worse.
Mm-hmm.
The people that can't stand Trump, I mean, they find him obnoxious in every way. If he wins, they're going to go berserk. And
right.
same if Biden wins, the MAGA people are going to go berserk. And I'm afraid they're going to do something they shouldn't do, and it's going to be really disruptive of the continuation of the country. But I think you could get a border bill that the entire Congress could agree on. But it would have to have a lot of stuff your supporters don't like and a lot of stuff in there their supporters don't like. And if you vote for that, you're not going to get reelected. So they're not going to do anything.
Yeah, it is interesting if you think about the two different outcomes this November. All right, Trump wins. That's good news. And we can kind of get some things back on track, whether that be the economy or closing the border or whatever. But what is the reaction from the left going to be? Maybe not even the supporters, but the people in Washington, D.C., the deep state or whatever. Their number one priority is railroading anything Donald Trump does and trying to stop him from being president even after he's inaugurated. If Trump loses, then the left gets to continue on this war path of ruining the country, and how does Trump supporters or people that are just disenfranchised at this point, how do they react to that? Especially if it plays out like it did in 2020 and everybody's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. You know, Joe Biden can't get 81 million
votes.
What
if they said to you, someone reliable called you and said, Andrew, let me talk to you for an hour about what the deep state is.
Mm-hmm.
You think you would be shocked out of your shoes? How it works, what it does, what they do that we couldn't tolerate. I mean, you know, draining the swamp sounded like a great idea to me.
It's a great catchphrase.
I mean, but it was also a great idea, except you have to, it's real, that swamp is real full, and they're real scary. I mean, that swamp does not have guppies in it. It's got big, mean alligators, crocodiles, boa constrictors, and all the rest. And if you try to drain it, you ask people, I'd like to drain the swamp. Yeah. Well, how about Shelby? Well, no. You know, he's my swamp monster. I like my swamp monster.
Right.
I don't like your swamp monsters. And
yeah.
So,
I think a lot of people, when it came to drain the swamp, again, great catchphrase, and everybody was agreeing with that. People supported Trump. And it seemed like it was a pretty simple thing. I mean, it's a simple catchphrase. It's a simple action. Just pull the plug, drain it. But I don't think, and this includes me, we fully understood what or how big or how entrenched the swamp was.
Or what would happen if we really did that.
Right.
What, you know, the unintended consequences might be as bad or worse than what we have now. So, you know, I'd like to know all that stuff, but you might have to put me in a rubber room after
yeah,
I found out.
Because, I mean, when you talk about the swamp or you talk about the deep state, I mean, originally we were thinking, okay, we're just talking about the politicians that we see on TV. That's the swamp. But then it starts bleeding over into the FBI, and the swamp is part of the FBI, the DOJ, the intelligence agencies, and you're like, oh, my God, this is deep.
Who was the guy and his paramour who were a big part of the FBI investigation? I have I'm bad with names, but I'm getting old, Andrew, and I can't retain them. But we would have had no idea if that hadn't have turned up. All these things, the Russian dossier.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that we might never have known.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Trump, we would have never known about James Comey and the FISA spying and all this other stuff that had been implemented after 9/11 that they were using against American people. Like, if Hillary Clinton would have been president, we'd have never known that. We'd still be bebopping around and just talking about, you know, social rah-rah Republican versus Democrat. We'd all still be on that page instead of realizing both parties suck and they both are trying to ruin the
country.
Exactly,
exactly. They are out for them. Here's the one thing you know. The politicians want to keep their jobs, and they don't give a half a damn about you mm-hmm. or me or Tony or John Byrd. You doing okay, John?
He's John great. I like his Tar Heels shirt, by the way. It's pretty cute.
And the guitar, John.
I actually forgot he was with us, so I'm glad you reminded us.
He's like those guys on Andy Griffith that are in the band, the Darlings.
Yeah, yeah. He's our in-house Muppet. Even when he is here, he's a Muppet. But yeah, it's just I think that's one of the appealing things for Trump, because people, you know, view me, and probably rightly so, as being ultra MAGA and being over
you
the
are.
Top Trump fan.
You are.
And there's so many reasons for that, but one of the big ones is the realization of what, you know, his presence helped a lot of us realize what was really going on, where, you know, I used to identify as a Republican, and I was, you know, rah-rah Republicans, boo the Democrats, it's just two teams fighting each other. And if it weren't for Trump, we wouldn't have realized that, because once Trump came on the scene and he's saying things that were brash, but I'm like, well, yeah, that's all the stuff we've been saying too. And Republicans were mad about it, and I'm like, wait a minute, we're on the same team. Why would you be mad about him saying that stuff? And then you start to realize, oh, it's because Republicans were never on your side. You may have identified with these guys, but they weren't sticking up for you like they said they were.
So let's pretend you are the representative of Republicans in Congress, and I'm the representative of Democrats. What are you willing to compromise on the border?
I think there's a lot of room for compromise, and the problem is both sides. I don't know that there's an extreme side of securing the border, considering our position now. I just say close it down all the way.
Would you be willing? I'm going to make you an offer.
Okay.
Would you be willing, if I could vacuum seal the border
mm-hmm.
and control the entry in accordance with the laws that exist now, no one gets in without going through the proper channels, in exchange for everybody that's already here gets the authority to stay here legally
yeah.
and can work and pay taxes, but you can't be a citizen. Would you accept that compromise? You weren't expecting this deep.
Well, I'm thinking about the current circumstances with the conservative number of 11 million people coming over just in the past 2 years.
That's conservative. Oh, not here now. It's 20 now, wouldn't you guess?
Oh, probably,
okay,
yeah.
So there's 20 million people we're going to let stay here, can work, can earn, gets the benefits of being here like a green card.
Right.
But all the benefits of being a legal resident, but you can never be a citizen, but we got to take them all in if we close the border. Tony, would you accept that compromise?
Well, normal, I'd think about it, but they have the right to vote. So, you know.
No vote.
No vote.
No citizen, no vote.
No, but even if they aren't citizens, they can vote if they have a Social Security card.
No, I'm okay.
What is a hypothetical?
They can illegally vote.
Okay.
But I'm talking about everything is going to abide by the law from this point on
yeah.
in exchange for letting all these people stay here.
Now, I would side with maybe potentially letting them stay here. However, if they committed any crime or did anything, they'd have to go.
Like, and be part of the rules. Yeah.
That's right. If you commit a felony while you're here and are convicted, then you got to go back.
It's just a whole lot of people. And so my thing, and this is where it's going to get dicey if Trump's elected, because he said, hey, we're going to deport these people.
It's impossible.
If you, it is going to be. I don't know how he's going to do it.
That's rhetoric. That's impossible.
But if you take away the people that have illegally come into the country over the past 2 years and say these guys are gone, and then everybody before this that came in illegally and are currently illegal, I say that's a pretty easy decision to make.
17 million you'll take if we can put the other 2 million back. 17 million.
I mean, it's going to be number.
15 million in 15 and 5 million. Million back. You'd accept that compromise. If you were in Congress and I was in Congress, we'd both lose our seats.
Yes, absolutely.
So now how can I get you to, assuming you want to keep your seat, which is really important to them, how am I going to get you to compromise? How am I going to get you to compromise anything on Israel or Ukraine?
Yeah,
I'm not even sure. They can't pass a bill for Israel. Just put it up a standalone bill. Support Israel. I mean,
I think the Israel thing could work if it weren't for so many on the left and Muslim Americans in particular being so against it. And even if it's a minority part of the voting bloc, Democrats are terrified of backlash from
Lauren
a group
Boebert
of people.
Doesn't want that. Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't want that. You've got the very far right doesn't want, they want to be isolationists again. So, again, if you compromise a little bit, you're going to lose. So we are, there's plenty of room for fear.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, radio plays into it, TV plays into it. That's what sells, and that's what people want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They want to hear, your audience wants to hear exactly what you're saying. And Al Franken's audience wanted to hear exactly what he's saying. So there's room in the media for that. But one of the things I admire about you and everybody at our station is we don't make any pretense of being journalists.
Right.
We are editors. We are editorial. We are opinion-based. We present the news. We try to present the news from other sources. Very little of that, except for what 1819 provides, is dug up by us. It's all secondhand. I get callers that call in and say, do you know that? How do you know that? So, well, I read it. I wasn't out at Mount St. Helens.
Right.
I saw some pictures, but I don't know exactly what happened except from reports. I don't know anything that's going on in Israel or Ukraine except for reports. So, no, I don't know it firsthand, but I have a pretty good feel that when all these reporting places, and now we're getting reporting places that are willing to tilt.
Yeah.
And so once we can't get the honest truth, I just have always wondered, you and Tony can help me with this, do you think a straight down the middle news station, which we thought CNN was when Turner started it, could draw enough income to survive now, or do you have to be biased one side or the other to make a living?
Yeah, I don't know that one could be successful now. I mean, the landscape has changed on how many options you have. I think one of the good angles has been, and I don't know how successful they've been because I haven't seen their ratings, but that News Nation channel.
Yes.
They're doing both sides. Instead of just doing it in the middle, they're like, hey, we got some lefties over here and some righties over here.
Was on there. A few other people
were
on
there. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly and Leland Vittert and some other people like that. I think it has a chance. People are dying for that. They want. I'll go back to my station and listen to your opinions, and I want to hear them because I like both sides' opinions so I can formulate my own conclusions from what I hear. But I have to have a source that I can trust as to what is fact and not opinion. And a lot of these stations on left and right don't delineate. They won't tell you. The guy, Rachel Maddow, clearly opinion, but never says that. And then some of the news people at both stations, the two ones, Fox and MSNBC and CNN, they don't tell you whether their opinion or presenting the news. So it's real blurry.
Yeah, they really do that. I mean, you know that, like, Don Lemon or, some of these other guys that would do primetime slots, Jesse Waters and such.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of known that they were, like, talk radio people, but when you get during the day, you watch MSNBC or you watch Fox News, like you're led with the belief that those guys are reporting the news, but if you really pay attention, they're leaning whichever direction they're supposed to. Yeah.
And, I mean, shows like The View.
Oh, God.
I mean, if you don't understand.
Now, people hate me when I play their clips on the show.
So bad.
I mean, I think it's a good. If you play ridiculous comments from both sides, I think that's very valuable to your listeners.
I think so, too.
It stirs them up, though. They have this kind of visceral.
Right.
Whoopi Goldberg says something like that. And you can feel them jumping, leaning up out of their chairs.
Yeah, people will say that they're never going to listen to the show again every time I play The View, and then they say that every time I play it. But there's a Rage Against the Machine song that is a classic, and it's called Know Your Enemy. And I think that is very important to know what your enemy, if the left is your enemy, you got to know them. You need to know them like they know themselves. Because you're not going to be able to defeat your enemy if you don't understand how they work.
Take the issue of voter ID. I don't see any argument against voter ID when they say, well, some people can't get ID. I'll run a bookmobile around every neighborhood and run like the ice cream man and put a sign up and said, if you want an ID, bring out your information or we'll walk to your door.
Right.
You show us your photo ID. Or anything that just convinces us who you are, and we'll give you an ID that enables you to vote.
Well, think about the money and resources they've spent in fighting voter ID laws. If they would have taken the same amount of money, they can make sure everybody in the country has four IDs apiece.
So now what's the other argument against? Some cases just don't have an argument against. Mm-hmm. I can see both sides of the border argument. I can see both sides of abortion arguments.
Mm-hmm.
I can see both sides of foreign aid arguments. But the side of having an ID to vote, I don't see the other side. We're not disenfranchising anybody. You let us know. We'll send a person out to your house and help you create a voter ID. Of course, if you're a dead person, that's going to be harder to do. If you're two people, that's going to be harder to do.
Well, it's insulting to say this group of people they don't have the means to get an ID. There's been several man on the street videos where a guy will go to East Harlem, all right, and he goes to the black people on the street and he says, so-and-so in Congress says it is racist to require an ID to vote because a lot of people in your community, in the black community, they don't have the means to get ID. Do you have an ID, sir? Well, yeah, I got an ID. What kind of question is that? And then after person, some of them would be like, that's an incredibly racist thing to assume that because we're black, we can't get an ID. And we're like, well, that's the argument they're making. It's disenfranchising black people. Why do Democrats think that black people can't get IDs? You got to have IDs to do everything. I mean, you get something to drink, you go to the bar, you get a hotel room, you know. You don't have to necessarily
go into a courthouse?
Yeah, you got to have it.
You go into a courthouse to get your driver's license or to get a tag or just to go in there and be on jury duty. I mean, you have to go present it. I don't, anyway.
But word's getting around for a lot of people, and I see more and more of this. I see, especially in the black community, more and more people talking about the history of the Democrat Party because there's an internal conversation happening with people of, man, we're really getting screwed by the Democrat Party. Why exactly have we been voting for them all this time? Because a lot of people are just, you know,
momentum.
It's an automatic vote.
Momentum.
You vote Democrat.
My daddy did it. My granddaddy did it.
Generations before me have voted Democrat. They always told me I grew up understanding they were for the working man, working for the black people. And so now they're all asking that question, and they're like, well, why is it we're still voting for these people? And then they're starting to hear conversations about, well, you know, this was the party of the KKK, and, you know, they were fighting against civil rights and all kind of everything else. And they're like, oh, really? Because maybe they knew that, but they didn't really comprehend it because somebody said, oh, they switched parties in whatever year and blah, blah, blah. But they're like, there's a lot of similarities to that. I mean, even when they do State of the Union, the Democrats are dressed in all white, you know? I mean, come on.
There are a lot of people who feel like this Republican Party is not Reagan's or going back before that,
right.
Eisenhower's. And Eisenhower, the frequently quoted statement is, beware the military-industrial complex, and he was right, and they got us.
Mm-hmm.
They got us by the shorts, and there's nothing we can do. But can you believe we run a business as big as the government, and we can't audit the military? They got $1 trillion worth of assets. They don't know where they are.
Well, that's that $2.3 trillion they announced the day before 9/11. Yeah. They're missing.
Never talked about that again. That was it.
And why can't we learn why Nancy Pelosi and the mayor of D.C. didn't want to accept troops on January 6th? Look, there's a reason you didn't. Just tell us.
Yeah.
Did you want this to happen? Did you foster this to happen? That might be in that room you go in, Andrew, where you might end up in the rubber room. What happened with that? It seems to me that when anybody asks for security, you ought to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel like you're in danger, say yes. And then they put a fence around. They put a fence around for things that happen now.
Right. It's so all about optics.
And I'm not right wing. In fact, probably of all the people that we associate with, I'm the leftist of them all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm big on women's rights. I'm big on women's health rights. I'm big on equal rights for all people. I'm big on transgender rights that I hear people come. I want equal rights for everyone. Someone said to me, American Civil Liberties Union is out of control, which they are.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, which civil liberties don't you like? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't like the word civil liberties are still okay. The organization went berserk.
Right.
Same with PETA.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't want dog fighting and cat skinning and animal burning and starvation. But, you know, when you stop a shopping center for a snail,
right.
I mean, you've gone off the edge. All these organizations gone off the edge.
And it hurts the whole message at the end of the day.
That's
and
right. It makes you look stupid.
Yeah.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has gone way, way left. But I loved what they did when they busted up the Klan. They just, their funding comes from the left, so they feed the left just like the TV stations. And the only thing that's real good for me is I'm a whole lot older than you. So if the big ship sinks, I might outlast it.
Yeah.
You two guys are not. How old are you?
I'm 38.
How old are you, Tony?
I'm 45.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm 73, so I'm up there.
Technically, Trish is 47, so I feel like that makes me a little more mature than my boss.
It does.
Kind of got it together.
It does.
You know, thank God for her, because I'd still be a hoodlum if it wasn't for...
Well, she
you
keeps
know.
You straight pretty much, or tries to.
She does. She does.
I already had a line prepared. I said, because John Byrd can't speak for himself right now. He's mute. But, you know, it's three of the craziest people we know at this one table together. In fact, John, you've never made as much sense as you did today.
Good John Byrd, great job today, by the way. You've done phenomenal. Put some glasses on that man.
There we go.
Good. Yes. Oh, looks so good.
I don't want him to go blind that way.
Right. He's got to be able to see the eclipse, too. You know, Bird had this idea of he was going to bring some trivia today.
Oh,
and he
was
going to quiz you.
Can we do this again?
Absolutely.
Good.
He just mentioned that on the show today during one of the breaks. I have no idea what it entailed.
Good. If you get stalled or out of ideas or the people abandon you, say, let's just come up here and do trivia. I'm good for that. I'm not afraid to embarrass myself. That's another thing about being 73 and beholden to no one. I don't have an employer. I don't have a wife. I don't have to make anybody happy with me. I can dress like I want. I can eat like I want. It's a great thing. You'll get there, Tony. You'll get there eventually.
He's probably getting close. I told Trish, I said, hey, we should do Andrew McClain trivia. And she's like, that is a stupid idea. Don't do that. So.
By the time Tony decides he's in the position to retire and be beholden to nothing, the national debt's going to be $75 trillion, and the Federal Reserve will have all the money, and he won't be able to enjoy life.
Tony will jump off a bridge at that point.
We'll just have $100 Big Macs at that point.
That's right.
Well,
110 with cheese.
Spud, it's been phenomenal. Anything you want to add, Tony Gump, before we get out of here?
Yeah, two things. One, I'd like in on that trivia sometime.
Good.
And two, getting back to your rubber room CIA stuff.
Yeah.
Just a little tidbit. Trump didn't release anything about JFK because George Bush Sr. was still alive. However, after he died, things started coming out. And if you really want to look into some things, the audience, look up the name of the magazine that JFK's son named. He named it after the person that killed his father, who was in the CIA, who later led the CIA named George Bush Sr.
So why did they push it back another 5 years?
That I have not privy to.
But
I
know
do
you're
know,
not privy,
you know.
But your imagination can run wild. And what is it if they won't release it, there's clearly something they don't want you to know.
Hmm.
And so what could that possibly be? And that's what breeds conspiracy theories. Yeah. I mean, it got Alex Jones to be a superstar and then bankrupt.
Now, I'll say this. If you were watching Alex Jones instead of Fox or CNN before or during the pandemic, you would have been way better off than if you were.
Yeah, Alex Jones was
he was dead on about a lot of stuff.
He was.
Were you at the station during the pandemic?
No, I did some fill-in stuff from home for Murphy. And
so you had a facility at home.
Yes, then. We this podcast was created after I got chit canned at 101, okay. And it was just in a much different form than this. But I had a little home studio that I was able to broadcast from. So I did some here and there from the house during that time. It was actually, I filled in for Murphy one time with Lindenberg, and it was the first time I met John Byrd, and I met him through like FaceTime through Zoom. And I was like, man, this cat right here, bro, he's a little strange. But little did I know
he's
going to be
nothing since to change your mind about that.
No, he's still crazy, but he's my partner, and I love the guy. There you go. Give John Byrd one more. There you go. Look at that. Four eyes.
I think you got to take a picture of that and put it up on your website.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be sending that.
Thank you for including me. This has been a lot of fun. I had a blast. I'm impressed with the studio, and hope some people enjoy it. Post the link if you can. And
We'll hook it up.
Text me with it, and I'll send it out to some people who've inquired. And Tony, when you're ready for trivia, I'm sitting on go.
We're going to hook it up. I bet you could do good stand-up. John Byrd and I are required to do a stand-up at an open mic soon because we lost the bracket thing. I bet you'd do pretty
That'd
good at
fun.
It.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun. I've been meaning to come out there to Springville. Is that where it is, Springville?
They have it.
No, what's the place you go out in Leeds?
Oh, Moody.
Yeah, Moody.
O'Sherry's.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we'll get out there sometime and cut up.
We got to hook
that
up.
On a Saturday night or a Sunday.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot of fun. I enjoy your show. Don't change a thing.
Absolutely. You know what Dixon told me when he came on? This was he was our first guest, and he goes, "You know what you need to do, Andrew? Quit talking about yourself when you open the show." He said, "Just talk about it later." And I was like, "Okay." You know, I didn't think a whole lot about it, and a listener started giving us the business, and they're like, "Don't you change a thing?" It's saying the same thing you said. So
your own identity, you're different than the other three, and it plays well, and so does the food show at night. All plays well. So
Trish kind of does the same thing. She's like, don't talk about your panic attacks. Don't talk about yourself so much.
Oh, I love the story about the keys.
Yeah, which one? I got like 10 keys.
And they're still running them on the morning show. They said, well, Andrew probably loses keys.
That's it. That's who I am. I'm a basket case.
Tony, I can't wait for the next time. Thanks, Andrew.
Absolutely.
My pleasure. I hope none of y'all went blind out there today, and he'll be on again at 11 o'clock tomorrow.
That's it. It's the Spud Eclipse. All right, guys, until next time. Circus! Hey.